Chapter 25. Man will do many things to get himself loved. He will do all things to get himself envied. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. Before I saw Australia, I had never heard of the eatweed at all. I met but few men who had seen it thrown, at least I met but few who mentioned having seen it thrown. Roughly described, it is a fat wooden cigar with its butt end fastened to a flexible twig. The whole thing is only a couple of feet long, and weighs less than 2 ounces. This feather, so to call it, is not thrown through the air, but is flung with an underhanded throw, and made to strike the ground a little way in front of the thrower. Then it glances and makes a long skip, glances again, skips again, and again and again, like the flat stone which a boy sends skating over the water. The water is smooth, and the stone has a good chance. So a strong man may make it travel 50 or 75 yards. But the wheat has no such good chance, for it strikes sand, grass, and earth in its course. Yet an expert aboriginal ascended a measured distance of 220 yards. It would have gone even further, but it encountered rank ferns and underwood on its passage and they damaged its speed. 220 yards. And so weightless a toy, a mouse on the end of a bit of wire, in effect, and not sailing through the accommodating air, but encountering grass and sand and stuff at every jump. It looks wholly impossible, but Mr. Brosmith saw the feat, and did the measuring, and set down the facts, in his book about Aboriginal life, which he wrote by command of the Victorian government. What is the secret of the feat? No one explains. It cannot be physical strength, for that could not drive such a feather weight any distance. It must be art. But no one explains what the art of it is, nor how it gets around that law of nature which says you shall not throw any 2 ounce thing 220 yards, either through the air or bumping along the ground. Rev. J. G. Wood says, the distance to which the wheat or kangaroo rat can be thrown is truly astonishing. I have seen an Australian stand at one side of Kennington Oval, and throw the kangaroo rat completely across it. Width of Kensington Oval not stated. T darts through the air with the sharp and menacing hiss of a rifle ball, its greatest height from the ground, being some 7 or 8 feet. When properly thrown it looks just like a living animal leaping along. Its movements have a wonderful resemblance to the long leaps of a kangaroo rat fleeing in alarm, with its long tail trailing behind it. The old settler said that he had seen distances made by the wheat in the early days, which almost convinced him that it was as extraordinary an instrument as the boomerang. There must have been a large distribution of acuteness among those naked skinny aboriginals, or they couldn't have been such unapproachable trackers and boomerangers and wheat-weeders. It must have been race-dash aversion that put upon them a good deal of the low-rate intellectual reputation which they bear, and have borne this long time in the world's estimate of them. They were lazy, always lazy. Perhaps that was their trouble. It is a killing defect. Surely they could have invented and built a competent house, but they didn't. And they could have invented and developed the agricultural arts, but they didn't. They went naked and houseless, and lived on fish and grubs and worms and wild fruits, and were just plain savages, for all their smartness. With a country as big as the United States, to live and multiply in, and with no epidemic diseases among them till the white man came with those, and his other appliances of civilization, it is quite probable that there was never a day in his history when he could muster 100,000 of his race in all Australia. He diligently and deliberately kept population down by infanticide largely, but mainly by certain other methods. He did not need to practice these artificialities anymore after the white man came. The white man knew ways of keeping down population which were worth several of his. The white man knew ways of reducing a native population 80% in 20 years. The native had never seen anything as fine as that before. For example, there is the case of the country now called Victoria, a country 80 times as large as Rhode Island, as I have already said. By the best official guess, there were 400-500 aboriginals in it when the whites came along in the middle of the 30s. Of these, 1,000 lived in Gippsland, a patch of territory the size of 15 or 16 Rhode Islands. They did not diminish as fast as some of the other communities. Indeed, at the end of 40 years there were still 200 of them left. The Geelong tribe diminished more satisfactorily. From 173 persons it faded to 34 in 20 years. At the end of another 20 the tribe numbered one person altogether. The two Melbourne tribes could muster almost 300 when the white man came. They could muster but 20, 37 years later, in 1875. In that year there were still odds and ends of tribes scattered about the colony of Victoria, but I was told that natives of full blood are very scarce now. It is said that the aboriginals continue in some force in the huge territory called Queensland. The early whites were not used to savages. They could not understand the primary law of savage life, that if a man do you a wrong, his whole tribe is responsible, each individual of it, and you may take your change out of any individual of it, without bothering to seek out the guilty one. When a white killed an aboriginal, the tribe applied the ancient law, and killed the first white they came across. To the whites this was a monstrous thing. Extermination seemed to be the proper medicine for such creatures as this. They did not kill all the blacks, but they promptly killed enough of them to make their own person safe. From the dawn of civilization down to this day the white man has always used that very precaution. Mrs. Campbell Prod lived in Queensland, as a child, in the early days, and in her Catches of Australian Life, we get informing pictures of the early struggles of the white and the black to reform each other. Speaking of pioneer days in the mighty wilderness of Queensland, Mrs. Prod says, "First the natives retreated before the whites, and, except that they every now and then speared a beast in one of the herds, gave little cause for uneasiness. But, as the number of squatters increased, each one taking up miles of country and bringing two or three men in his train, so that shepherds' huts and stockmen's camps lay far apart and defenseless in the midst of hostile tribes, the blacks' depredations became more frequent, and murder was no unusual event. The loneliness of the Australian bush can hardly be painted in words. Here extends mile after mile of primeval forest, where perhaps foot of white man has never trod, interminable vistas, where the eucalyptus trees rear their lofty trunks and spread forth their lanky limbs, from which the red gum oozes and hangs in fantastic pendants like crimson stalactites, ravines along the sides of which the long-bladed grass grows rankly, level untimbered plains alternating with undulating tracts of pasture, here and there broken by a stony ridge, steep gully, or dried-up creek. All wild, vast and desolate. All the same monotonous gray coloring, except where the wattle, when in blossom, shows patches of feathery gold, or a belt of scrub lies green, glossy, and impenetrable as Indian jungle. The solitude seems intensified by the strange sounds of reptiles, birds, and insects, and by the absence of larger creatures, of which in the daytime, the only audible signs are the stampede of a herd of kangaroo, or the rustle of a wallaby, or a dingo stirring the grass as it creeps to its lair. But there are the whirring of locusts, the demoniac chuckle of the laughing jackass, the screeching of cockatoos and parrots, the hissing of the frilled lizard, and the buzzing of innumerable insects hidden under the dense undergrowth. And then at night, the melancholy wailing of the curlews, the dismal howling of dingoes, the discordant croaking of tree frogs, might well shake the nerves of the solitary watcher. That is the theater for the drama. When you comprehend one or two other details, you will perceive how well suited for trouble it was, and how loudly it invited it. The cattlemen stations were scattered over that profound wilderness miles and miles apart, at each station half a dozen persons. There was a plenty of cattle. The black natives were always ill-nourished and hungry. The land belonged to them. The whites had not bought it, and couldn't buy it, for the tribes had no chiefs, nobody in authority, nobody competent to sell and convey, and the tribes themselves had no comprehension of the idea of transferable ownership of land. The ousted owners were despised by the white interlopers, and this opinion was not hidden under a bushel. More promising materials for a tragedy could not have been collated. Let Mrs. Prod speak. Tenai Station, one dark night, the unsuspecting hut keeper, having, as he believed, secured himself against assault, was lying wrapped in his blankets sleeping profoundly. The blacks crept stealthily down the chimney, and battered in his skull while he slept. One could guess the whole drama from that little text. The curtain was up. It would not fall until the mastership of one party or the other was determined and permanently. Here was treachery on both sides. The blacks killed the whites when they found them defenseless, and the whites slew the blacks in a wholesale and promiscuous fashion which offended against my childish sense of justice. They were regarded as little above the level of brutes, and in some cases were destroyed like vermin. Here is an instance. A squatter, whose station was surrounded by blacks, whom he suspected to be hostile, and from whom he feared an attack, parleyed with them from his house door. He told them it was Christmas time, a time at which all men, black or white, feasted, that there were flour, sugar plums, good things in plenty in the store, and that he would make for them such a pudding as they had never dreamed of, a great pudding, of which all might eat and be filled. The blacks listened and were lost. The pudding was made and distributed. Next morning there was howling in the camp, for it had been sweetened with sugar and arsenic. The white man's spirit was right, but his method was wrong. His spirit was the spirit which the civilized white has always exhibited toward the savage, but the use of poison was a departure from custom. True, it was merely a technical departure, not a real one. Still, it was a departure, and therefore a mistake, in my opinion. It was better, kinder, swifter, and much more humane than a number of the methods which have been sanctified by custom, but that does not justify its employment. That is, it does not wholly justify it. Its unusual nature makes it stand out, and attract an amount of attention which it is not entitled to. It takes hold upon morbid imaginations and they work it up into a sort of exhibition of cruelty, and this smirches the good name of our civilization, whereas one of the old harsher methods would have had no such effect, because usage has made those methods familiar to us and innocent. In many countries we have chained the savage and starved him to death, and this we do not care for, because custom has inured us to it. Yet a quick death by poison is loving kindness to it. In many countries we have burned the savage at the stake, and this we do not care for, because custom has inured us to it. Yet a quick death is loving kindness to it. In more than one country we have hunted the savage, and his little children and their mother with dogs, and guns through the woods and swamps for an afternoon's sport, and filled the region with happy laughter over their sprawling and stumbling flight, and their wild supplications for mercy. But this method we do not mind, because custom has inured us to it. Yet a quick death by poison is loving kindness to it. In many countries we have taken the savage's land from him, and made him our slave, and lashed him every day, and broken his pride, and made death his only friend, and overworked him till he dropped in his tracks. And this we do not care for, because custom has inured us to it. Yet a quick death by poison is loving kindness to it. In the Matabi land today, why, there we are confining ourselves to sanctified custom. We Rhodes beat millionaires in South Africa and dukes in London, and nobody cares, because we are used to the old holy customs, and all we ask is that no notice inviting new ones shall be intruded upon the attention of our comfortable consciences. Mrs. Pratt says of the poisoner, that squatter deserves to have his name handed down to the contempt of posterity. I am sorry to hear her say that. I myself blame him for one thing, and severely, but I stop there. I blame him for the indiscretion of introducing a novelty which was calculated to attract attention to our civilization. There was no occasion to do that. It was his duty, and it is every loyal man's duty to protect that heritage in every way he can, and the best way to do that is to attract attention elsewhere. The squatter's judgment was bad, that is plain, but his heart was right. He is almost the only pioneering representative of civilization in history who has risen above the prejudices of his caste and his heredity and tried to introduce the element of mercy into the superior race's dealings with the savage. His name is lost, and it is a pity, for it deserves to be handed down to posterity with homage and reverence. This paragraph is from a London journal. Oh, learn what France is doing to spread the blessings of civilization in her distant dependencies. We may turn with advantage to New Caledonia. With a view to attracting free settlers to that penal colony, M. Fallet, the governor, forcibly expropriated the Kanaka cultivators from the best of their plantations, with a derisory compensation, in spite of the protests of the Council General of the island. Such immigrants as could be induced to cross the seas thus found themselves in possession of thousands of coffee, cocoa, banana, and breadfruit trees, the raising of which had cost the wretched natives years of toil, whilst the latter had a few 5-franc pieces to spend in the liquor stores of Noumea. You observe the combination? It is robbery, humiliation, and slow murder, through poverty and the white man's whiskey. The savage's gentle friend, the savage's noble friend, the only magnanimous and unselfish friend the savage has ever had, was not there with the merciful swift release of his poisoned pudding. There are many humorous things in the world, among them the white man's notion that he is less savage than the other savages. See chapter on Tasmania, post. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.